You're listening to the Straight to Video Podcast with Rob Lane.
What is going on? We're back. Another episode of the currently weekly Straight to Video Podcast. Today is a real treat as I chat with Stevie James, who was the lead singer for the band Tiger Tales on their debut LP, Young and Crazy, which was released in 1987. And this year celebrates its 35th anniversary, which will be marked by a one-off gig in London on Saturday, October the 15th, with the album being played in its entirety for the first time ever. Stevie has been on some kind of journey, and we get to hear what is probably just a snippet of it, but there's still so much in this conversation. We talk about his childhood getting into music, his very first bands and concerts. We talk about getting the gig with Tiger Tales and the response the band had when they first started. We chat about his exit from the band, time in the USA out in Hollywood, rubbing shoulders with the big names of the time, and so much more. I can't wait for you to hear it. But before we dive in, though, I hope you'll grab yourself some Dead Skull Coffee, who continue to be supporters of this show with their awesome ground and full bean rock and roll coffee. If you order through their website and enter the promo code STV on checkout at deadskullcoffee.co.uk, you will bag yourself a mighty 15% off your order as a thank you for listening to this show. So please check them out and support a brilliant independent company. Also, as we speak on the release of this episode, today is the day that we're opening the doors for a special preview night of the Straight to Video 80s Video Shop in Alfreton, Derbyshire. Yes, that is right. You will be able to step back in time and relive those awesome Friday nights, picking out a film to watch in our own recreation of an 80s video shop. We've gone and created what is effectively a VHS museum where you can see all the classic films on the old video shelves along with some arcade machines, all the old posters, and we hope we can bring back some of those special memories. You can grab some cool photos and we have a bunch of fun stuff for sale too, which will help support the shop. So when we officially open later this month, I hope you can pop in if you're in the area. In the meantime though, look out for a bunch of early photos which will be popping up all over social media at 80s Video Shop on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, so all follows and likes are appreciated. Alright, enough of that, let's go back to 1987 and get young and crazy all over again as we dive into my straight to video chat with the legend that is Mr. Stevie James.
Fucking great start to the day, that was. I don't want to swear, it makes me sound like a thug and a fucking thick cunt, but I just wondered if I slip into it. You know what I mean? I do swear a lot, but Robin always says, why'd you call everybody a cunt? I said, well, because most of them are. And he said, no, that's not the way to do it. You know what I mean?
Mate, you've screwed up already, because I'm recording from the get-go anyway, just in case there's any gold. And there's some gold straight away there. So.
Oh, shit. Oh, well, you know, it is me. You get what you get. And I suppose I do sound a bit thick, but I can assure people I'm not.
How are you though, mate? You all right?
I'm good. How are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm all good. All good. Very good to speak to you rather than messages over WhatsApp and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a long, well, you know, it's been a long while. It's been, me and Rob been planning that since March last year. I looked into the messages the other day.
Crazy, man. Well, time's going too quick, which I'm sure we'll agree once we start talking about stuff. It's like, is it really that long ago?
Oh, tell me, mate. I spoke to my friend, my school friend, who I grew up with, you know, known him since I was 8 years old, and we were talking about the 70s, and we were just like, where did it go? Why didn't we appreciate it? But, you know, it doesn't go fast, but when you get old, it seems to have gone really fast.
When did it kick in for you? For me, it was 30. That's when shit started, like, really speeding up.
Mate, I'm 60 years old. Can you believe that? I thought I'd be dead.
mate. We're still here, though. You're hanging in there.
Well, yeah. I mean, my health's gone down the crap hole, but I'm still, you know, I'm still keeping on top of things. But I don't know when it started. I mean, I don't want to go on about that kind of stuff. But when I lost my dad, spark out of my life went away. You know what I mean? And I didn't really want to do anything. Rock and roll was like, you know, that's for the young kids. I mean, they're doing it okay. You know, certain things happened in my life, and I just thought, do I really need to put myself through all this stuff anymore? No. Leave it to the kids, you know what I mean?
This stuff you worried about so, so much when you was younger, it's the tiniest things now.
Oh, tell me about it, mate. Yeah, well, you know, once you've got commitments and families and all the rest of it, you know, it puts a perspective on everything else, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not to sound like an old bastard, but I still love my rock and roll. I always will do till I die, you know.
It's too ingrained in you, though, mate, that is. It's never going to go away.
Oh, mate, since I was knee-high to a grasshopper, and most people would say, well, I'm still knee-high to a grasshopper, you know what I mean? But yeah, it's been ingrained in me since the first album that I got that I wouldn't say it changed my world, but it did change things about things, you know, and it was Wings, Band on the Run, 1974. I love that album to this day.
Whereabouts did you hear that?
Obviously, Jet used to be on the radio a lot, the single Jet. I always loved McCartney more than I loved Lennon. I mean, that's some people, that's sacrilege, you know what I mean? But that's the way it was for me. And I've always been a McCartney fan. My nan used to tell me I'd dance around the kitchen saying, put the Beatles on, put the Beatles on, when I was a little kid, you know?
Where was this? Are you like London born and bred, or where are you from originally?
No. I lived in a tiny village stroke town, just about 15 or so miles out of Oxford. That's where I grew up, in the middle of the country, nothing but fields.
Ah, lovely.
When we were at school, it's different. Obviously, it was way different back then. We used to have vinyl albums coming in and out of school, and people would swap them, and you'd end up with this album, you'd end up with that album. I think the classic one I ever did at school was about, when did Destroyer come out? 75, 76?
Yeah, it was just like, just post Alive. So yeah, it was around that time.
I remember a kid bringing that into school. Can you believe this? I looked at the cover and I said, these look a bit stupid. They'll never last.
So you didn't think it looked cool? You didn't think that cover was like, holy shit, what is this?
I was never into Marvel comics and all that. And I love the cover. I mean, the cover was spectacular. And to this day, ironically, I think it's the best, 35, 40 minutes Kiss ever did. I love that album.
That and Love Gun back to back. Coming off Alive into Destroyer and Love Gun. It's nuts.
Well, I bought Love Gun on red vinyl back in the 70s for £1.99 from High Wycombe. I've still got the copy here now.
Is it a bit battered around the edges?
No, because my school friend, he always has a go at me. Well, not a go at me. He always laughs about it. He said, Steve, I never knew anybody as anal as you at school. All your records were in alphabetical order and they were all perfect and you wouldn't let anybody touch them.
Yeah. So you were borrowing everybody else's albums. You weren't loaning them.
I'll tell you a little story. I bought Kansas Left Overture when I was at school. I don't know what year it came out. It was about 76 or something like that. Anyway, I lent it to a friend of mine because that's what we did at school. We borrowed records and we swapped records and we all vinyls, obviously. And he brought it back to me and the cover was all, it looked like someone had melted it, you know, on the corner. It was all the glue had come away.
The fucking worst. I've done that before. Loan people.
Yeah, that is what stopped me doing it. And I said to him, I said, what the fuck have you done to my record? He said, oh yeah, sorry about that. I was at the bus stop. It was raining and I left it in the rain. That was the day I said, no more lending out. Someone ruined my first pressing copy, which is worth a lot of money now, of Aerosmith, the first album, obviously. I kind of got over that because they scratched it to death, you know. And the Kansas Left Overture record, that was it for me. No more swapping.
Was that the first person you called a cunt?
No. I had a lot of fights at school, but we won't go there. I never did really grow up. I think it was the mini man in me, the small man syndrome. You know what I mean?
Have you got brothers and sisters that stuck up for you?
My sister's younger than me, so no, I didn't have a brother, older brother to stick up for me. But I have a lot to thank my friends' older brothers for, because they were the ones who had all the vinyl. They knew what was going on. They had all the American bands. And that's when I first discovered Black Oak Arkansas, my favourite band. Raunch and Roll.
Yeah? What was it special about them?
Jim Dandy.
Yeah? Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Tommy Aldridge was in the band when I got into them. Raunch and Roll, 75, the live album. And it's one of my favourite albums ever.
Is that an album that made you want to play in a band, do you think?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, I used to go to gigs all the time. I mean, the first gig I ever went to, my friend's older brother, who bought all the new records that came out, you know, he bought Meatloaf when it first came out. And we were like, wow, the cover's amazing. But we didn't really get the music, if you know what I mean. He took me and my friend to see Rush on the 2112 tour in 1977 at Hammersmith Odeon. And that blew my mind. My favorite Rush album is to this day is 2112. And they played the whole lot. It was incredible. It was like they played all the worlds of stage plus Xanadu, which they were recording at the time, I think.
But seeing Rush as your first gig, does that make you want to play in a band? Or do you think, shit, I'm never going to be able to do that?
Do you know what, mate? My memories, probably because of all the drink and drugs I've taken over the years, my memory from back when I was a kid, some of it's photographic, some of it is just gone. And my friend said, I remember you always wanted to be in a band, always, always. And I can't remember what the spark was for it. But my mum's mum sang in the clubs in London, you know, during the Blitz and all that. They got moved out to down here. That's how they ended up down here. My nan could play any musical instrument by ear. And my granddad was ambidextrous and he was a drummer. So it all comes from there, you know, even though my mum's not musical in the slightest, my mum's sister was. So the family's got all that in it. You know what I mean? And my dad, when he was younger, he was an avid singles collector. He used to buy all the American imports, you know, all the stuff. I mean, all the regular stuff like Buddy Holly and Bill Haley and all that stuff. And we had it all at home, you know. And now, since he passed away, I've got them all here.
That's weird you mention like Buddy Holly and all that kind of stuff. Because like here we are, 35 years since 1987, talking about the debut Tiger Tales album, Young and Crazy, which came out that year.
Yep.
Talking about that now, that's like talking about something in 1987 that would have been released in the early 50s.
I know.
What would Stevie James have said back then if, like, you're going to be talking about this album 35 years, recorded for Music for Nations, still going to be talking about it nearly four decades later?
When we were writing those songs, you know, we weren't inventing the wheel, but what we were doing is we were doing glam rock, but we had a little bit of a punky attitude and a very, very big new wave of British attitude, new wave of British heavy metal. Me and Fincham did anyway. And I think those songs are a mixture of that. And they're different to all the other glam bands who ever came out of America, and mainly that's due to my Jim Dandy gruffy voice, you know, because I wasn't a squeaker. And I think that's what stood us apart in the end. But yeah, recording that album, we did that album twice. Did you know that?
I know, obviously you did the EP, didn't you?
Well, what happened was that was self-financed. When I first joined the band, I went down there and I wasn't really enamored with the songs or everything, but I got on with Mick, Jay, and I got on with the boy, Pepsi. Ended up moving in with the Pepsi and his mum. And I wasn't that happy. So I went off to do this audition with Tokyo Blade. And I was really, really, really planning my life with Tokyo Blade. I thought, oh, this is a dream job, you know, I've got to get it. So I came up to London. I went up to London, I should say, or down to London. And I auditioned for Tokyo Blade. And obviously, I didn't get the job. I can't remember who got the job, but the band kind of disbanded after that anyway. I went back down to Cardiff and I said, right, if we're going to do this, we need to write some good songs. That's where Shoot to Kill, Living Without You and She's Too Hot came from.
What was the writing process? Did like Jay have some riffs or do you just jam stuff out?
Mick always had good riffs. I always thought he had good riffs always, you know. When he finished work on a Friday, he used to drop off this tape at my house and it was full of riffs, nothing but riffs. And I'd sit there and go through an hour's worth of riffs and I'd go back to him and I'd say, right, I like this one. Let's work on this. Let's work on that. I remember Young and Crazy getting the riff. And I thought, wow, this is cool. This is heavy as well. That's how we worked on it like that. We'd never sat down and thoroughly went through, oh, this key, that key, this key. You know, we just got a vibe going, you know what I mean? But the EP came about because we just needed some good songs. And I came up with Shoot to Kill because I can't play guitar, but I'm pretty good at writing songs or melodies, let's say that. I had this melody in my head, you know, dressed up and I'm ready. And I said to Mick, just play a simple riff, dun, 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 and he did. And the song was structured around that. Living Without You, I don't really remember how it came about, but there's two or three different versions on the internet, I think. And obviously the third version was the version we used on the EP. So we've self-financed that EP, but we self-financed it as a demo tape. Then we had no drummer at the time. So I said, look, I know this guy, Steve Pierce from Tokyo Blade. I'm going to ask him if he wants to play drums on the demo. Luckily for us, he said yes. So that's not Ace on that EP. Although his picture's on there, I mean, the cassette tape's hilarious. It's me dressed as him on the cassette tape.
For real?
I've got a big black hat and sunglasses. It's obviously me, but, you know, we kind of made the pictures small so you couldn't tell it was him. We knew he was coming over, so we were confident with it all, you know.
Well, where does yours and Ace's history go back to? Because you've been playing together for a while in, like, Treason and Crash KO.
Treason, mate. That's the first time I ever met him, you know. Was we both auditioned for a band in Oxford called Treason, new wave of British heavy metal band. We both got the job on the same night, and that's how I met him.
What did you both think of each other back then, do you know?
Do you know what, Rob? I don't know what it is, but I've always been fascinated with Americana and all the cars and just the whole thing. He lived on the American Air Force Base down in Upper Hayford. It's long gone now, but we used to go down there in my car, and it was like driving into America, and I loved it.
Oh, wow.
When he turned up for the audition, I was outside. He said he always remembers what I said when I first walked in the room. He said, "All right, mate, it's pissing down out there," but I don't remember that. But I remember his dad's car. It was a great big, like a hatchback, massive American car, and it had an electric window on the back, you know, where the gate comes up. I was like, fucking hell, this is like a fucking flying saucer.
You're probably the same as me then, because I've got a lot of family in America, but to me, growing up as a kid, my cousins and my aunties and my uncles, they were like rock stars to me when they came over. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was weird because, like I say, growing up, one of my favourite albums from back then was Toys in the Attic, Aerosmith, and I just loved a lot of American music. I just did. I mean, I liked all the glam stuff when I was a kid, Sweet and Slade and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I wasn't a massive David Bowie fan. I wasn't a massive T-Rex fan, but I was a big Slade and a big Sweet fan, and I loved Wizard as well.
Yeah.
That's where the glam thing kind of stemmed from, I guess. Ace and I had this dream, this vision, if you like. Well, I certainly did. I think it happened in 79 or 80. I'm not really sure on the year. Someone would know. The end of the 70s, definitely. We were both driven the same way. You know what I mean? He was American. I was English. That was the only difference. But we had the same drive. And Treason morphed in to Crash KO because, you know, the guys along the way had girlfriends, and it used to really fucking cheese me off when you'd say, "Right, we're rehearsing this week." And they'd say, "No, I'm going out with my girlfriend bird watching." I mean, I love bird watching, but, you know, I was like, no, we got to rehearse for this gig. And it kind of all crumbled. And in the end, we just ended up with me and Fincham. Fortunately, not unfortunately, we had a bass player called Rupert who recently joined the band. He was a great bass player, good musician. He was obviously in the band. So the three of us, I put an advert, I think it was in Sounds back then, Sounds or Melody Maker, one of those, you know, the ads, free ads at the back. We wanted a guitar player. And I put this advert in there. There was something mentioned of Randy Rhodes, I think, somewhere along the line. And I had this guy called Phil Tiger at the time, who is obviously Phil Vokins. He phoned me up. I remember him saying something about Randy Rhodes. And I was like, okay. He said, "Right, we'll meet." And we met him at a service station in Oxford. And when he got out of his car, he was like a Martian. He had massive blonde spiky hair. And me and Fincham looked at him and looked at each other and we went, "That's the guy." That's how Treason / Crash KO was born. And he was a phenomenal guitar player. He had loads of ideas. He was older than us, so he'd had far more experience, you know.
So he was a great player, older, looked cooler. This was your guy who was you looking up to.
Yeah, this is our image that morphed from Treason to Crash KO because we all dyed our hair white, all four of us.
How was that process? Did it go to plan?
Mate, when they dyed my hair, I have to watch what I say here. When they dyed my hair blonde, because I was into Quo and all that American stuff and just the greasy look, do you know what I mean? And I said, "No, I don't want to look like those stupid bands, you know." But anyway, obviously I dyed my hair blonde, but it was white. Mine's quite blonde anyway. And it went white. And I remember looking in the mirror when I dyed it and I thought, "Jesus Christ, I look like Ulrich Roth." It was hilarious, you know. It was like someone looking back at me who wasn't me because I've been so used to having greasy, dirty blonde hair. It was an eye-opener. And, you know, Phil was the instigator of that. And that's how the all four white-haired blokes came along. This is before we really knew about Motley Crue. This was 81, 82. And Phil had been in America and he brought back Too Fast for Love, you know. And Fincham absolutely went gaga over it. I thought it was a great album. But I remember back in the day, I said to Fincham, "I like it, but it's too much like Cheap Trick." And I love Cheap Trick, you know, they're one of my favourite bands. In hindsight, now, it is their best album, in my opinion. So, you know, in a long-winded way, that's how Treason kind of fell apart along the way. I mean, I was writing songs about the devil, mate, back then. Depths of Hell and Devil's Daughter and Revenge. And so Crash KO was kind of, well, it was a glam band. in retrospect, it was a glam band, you know. So then we had to start writing songs about this and that. And I wrote a song called Star Attraction, actually, when I was in Crash KO that we used. You know, there was a few titles and a few words I stole from Crash KO. Well, I wrote them myself anyway, so I didn't really steal them.
Brought them back.
Yeah. Well, Star Attraction, obviously. I needed a title and I thought, I always liked that title, Star Attraction. So that's where that title came from. That's a Crash KO title. We were massively, I'm talking massively, into the new wave of British heavy metal. Fincham and I were huge, huge new wave. My favourite band back then was Diamond Head and Angel Witch. We saw all these bands, more or less when they just started off, you know, when it was fresh. And I can't tell you what it was like. The new wave of British heavy metal, if you were into that kind of stuff, was like a massive breath of fresh air. It was brilliant. It was like a movement. You had Def Leppard, Iron Maiden, obviously, Saxon. And I saw these bands, you know, when they first started, and it was just magical. I remember me and Fincham, we had to have these white boots that they were all wearing, these white bumper boots, you know. So we went out looking for these bumper boots and a little Steve Harris gig bag. It was like little kids. Although we were, you know, I think I was in probably 20 by then. I don't know.
You're still a kid at the end of the day.
Yes.
You're looking back, you're still a kid.
Absolutely, Rob. You know what? It was fun. It was just fun. It was all new and it was all fun. We were coming off the back of Boston, Meatloaf, all those American bands, as I said before, Kansas, Aerosmith. It was brilliant. It was great fun and great time to be alive, mate.
This is all obviously pre-Tiger Tales. What was the band Idle Threat? Was that the one you actually went to America?
That's when I first went to the States, just before the spring of 85. I went over to Colorado Springs because they said, you've got to come over. We need a singer. And back then, I didn't think anything of it. I just thought, oh, yeah, I'll just jump on a plane. I'll go to America. I'd never been out of my village.
What did you tell Customs and Immigration?
They got... They opened my suitcase and I was just a naive sod, you know. They opened it and they said, are you an entertainer? And I was like, no, that's just my clothes that I wear, you know. And they went through all my clothing. And this is 1985, so I don't know what it's like nowadays. But I thought, why are they going through all my clothes? What's that all about?
That's the naivety, though. You don't realise what you've said or anything.
Mate, I just thought, because my friend's older brother's mate had been there, I thought I was geared up for it, or he told me what to do and everything. And when they said, how long do you plan to stay? I looked at the bloke and I said, indefinitely. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, indefinitely. I don't know how long I'm going to stay. And he said, well, you're going to stay 3 months. And he stamped my passport.
Wow. So this is like the first time you've been to America.
Mate, this is the first time I've been out of my village.
So how was it seeing it in real life? Your only interaction had been film and TV and Ace Fincham. That's all you knew.
I'd never been on a plane. It was like going into space. The flights were terrible. I had to change in St. Louis and Boston. And I finally got to Colorado Springs and it was a massive, I'm talking massive snowstorm. And the plane had to circle around the airport for ages. And I hate flying. I'm talking white knuckle ride. But I was so tired. I didn't really know what was going on. Now, I got through customs at Colorado Springs and I could hear Fincham before I saw him. And he was telling the guitar player, Dave, he was saying, you'll recognize him instantly. He'll be glam. And I had a suit and tie on.
No way.
I swear to God, because I thought I'd get through customs easier. It didn't work like that, obviously. So they were looking for this glam rock bloke with spiky blonde hair. I had flat blonde hair and a suit and tie. Yeah.
What a legend.
That's right. I first set foot in America, 1985.
What a time, though.
Oh, mate, it was just before the explosion.
You had MTV.
Mate, I had three channels. You know what it was like? We had three channels in England. I went to America and they had about 50,000. They took me to the bank one day to deposit some money that they, I don't know who did it. And we drove up to the bank and they put it in a hole and it went. And I was like, is that it? You know, in England, we walk into a bank, wait in line. Get your little book and do it. Yeah, it was surreal when I first got there, mate. It was a big eye-opener.
So what was Idle Threat like? Was that Idle Threat a band which was getting into like Rat and Bon Jovi, or what kind of direction was it going?
It was a covers band. So when I got there, Fincham already had Idle Threat. Don't know what happened to their singer. Obviously, he'd left under what circumstances, I have no idea. So I was thrust into this band. And when I got there, I had to learn 50 or 60 cover versions. Def Leppard, Rat, Motley, Accept, you name it. I had to learn all these songs. And we'd rehearse for hours at a time in a basement, cover versions. And when it came to do a gig, we had this bright idea of doing originals. Jag Panzer, this band from Colorado Springs, were headlining. And we got the opening spot on it and we were all excited. We had this bright idea. Well, we haven't really got any originals. So we nicked a load of songs from demos we had from England. Fincham said, let's do Set the Stage Alight by, I can't remember the name of the band now. A pretty well-known new wave of British heavy metal band. And I hated the song. And I said, but it's shit. He said, yeah, but nobody will know that. So we were doing all these cover versions. Unbeknownst to the audience, they were cover versions to me and Fincham, but they were like our own songs. It was weird. You know, Idle Threat, it was great fun. It, you know, rehearsing every day, sunbathing afterwards. It was fun. But we did a lot of hard work and we never really went anywhere for that hard work to pay off, you know.
How long was you over there for?
I outstayed my visa quite a long way. So I went in... Yeah, I didn't get caught, but I was dodging, you know what I mean? I didn't know if they'd catch me or whatever. But I think I got there just after my birthday in February of 85, and I was back home in England in time for Donington.
Right, you had to get back for Monster Rock.
Yeah, August time, yeah.
Which lineup was that then in 85?
Mate, I think it was the one Rat played with Metallica or Anthrax and Bon Jovi in that.
Right, nuts.
Yeah, it was a bizarre lineup, but Bon Jovi, I remember when I first saw Bon Jovi, they were brilliant. He was climbing the monitors, he was climbing the rigging, and I thought, wow, this is great, you know. Obviously, that wasn't really Bon Jovi. They went on to be more mellow than that. But it was a weird lineup. Yeah, I think either Metallica or Accept were stuck between Rat and Bon Jovi. I could be wrong, but the lineup was a bit strange, yeah.
So you've come back. How long was it before you joined Tiger Tales, and how did you hear about the vacancy for a singer?
What happened was I came back, and my mum was adamant I get a job and pay her back the money that she sent me out to buy my return ticket, because I went out without a return ticket.
Obviously.
She didn't know what jet lag was, I don't think, and she was kicking me. I was sleeping on my sister's floor in her bedroom, because obviously I'd left home when I went to America, kicking me out of bed. I've got your job, I've got your job. And I was like, no, I'm jet lagged to fuck. What are you playing at? Anyway, she got me this job. I went and started a new job. And all the time I was there, I was looking around in sounds for adverts for bands to go and audition for. In October of 85, I saw this advert and it was Mop Top. Ah, oh, it's so long ago. I can't remember what the advert actually said, but I remember something like along the lines of Mop Top metal band seek blah, blah, blah vocalist. So I went home, I rang this number, and obviously it was the boy. And I spoke to him on the phone, and we set up an audition, and I had to go down to Cardiff.
Where was your headspace at? Like, this band's not in London, or it's not in my hometown. I've got to go all the way to Wales.
Yeah, I had no idea, mate. I was so driven to get into a band and do what I wanted to do that I didn't care. It could have been on Mars for all I cared.
How did you get there? Did you go on the train or the bus?
I bussed it there. Yeah, the first time I ever went, I bussed it there. This is the weirdest thing of all. I've got to tell you this story. I got on the bus. It went through a load of different towns and whatever, you know. And it stopped at this one place. And this guy got on with really blonde, white, spiky hair. And I looked at him and I thought, Jesus, I know that guy. And it was Phil Vokins. He was going down to audition for Persian Risk.
Holy shit.
Yeah. Weird little coincidences throughout your life, isn't there, like that? So we were talking all the way down there.
That's crazy. Did you all hit it off when you first met? Because obviously Ace wasn't involved at this point.
They had two guitar players. Jay, I always call him Mick. So for people who are listening, Mick is Jay Pepper. So there was Mick. There was the boy, Pepsi. Another guitar player, I think his name was Tosh, something like that. And a drummer, can't remember his name now. Robin replaced him in Ragdolls, I do know that. So it was a five-piece when I went down there. I know the drummer didn't want me. I knew that from the get-go. Apparently, I mean, he probably wouldn't remember and maybe wouldn't admit it anyway. But apparently, as soon as Mick set eyes on me, he said to the boy, we got to have him. That's what I was told, you know. But they had me doing these bizarre songs in like this little recording studio, you know, like those 10 bob ones. It wasn't a massive big rehearsal space with a huge recording studio, but they had the glass separating it and stuff like that. And the drummer sat there and he went, why don't you do Cry Me a River, Aerosmith? And I thought, well, it's not Aerosmith's song anyway. And how the fucking hell am I going to sing like Steven Tyler? I don't know how it sounded, but I warbled my way through that and a load of other covers and some of their own songs. They had Walking on Air and, oh God, I can't remember the others. They'd already done a demo with their old singer, Jim Dovey. So I had these other songs that I had to audition with. And obviously I got the job.
What was the reaction to the band when you went out live? Obviously America was a hotbed for bands with this over-the-top image and like super catchy songs. But who was there over here in the UK other than yourselves at that time?
There was no one. I mean, people say, oh, Rothschild were before you. They were better, this and that. We thought Rothschild were a comedy band, you know. We didn't want to be like that anyway. So there was no connection to us and them. And that was basically the only band that were doing that kind of thing, weren't they? We wanted to be metal. Me and Mick were into metal. Let me tell you that. The boy was into Hanoi Rocks and a lot of other tubes and a lot of bands like that. And me and Mick were into metal. We both loved Status Quo as well. So the first gig I played with Tiger Tales, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, kind of like, what was the reaction?
Horrendous.
Yeah.
Horrendous. Horrendous. You would not believe what was thrown at us. Pint mugs. Pint mugs. I'm talking the old ones with the handle and the little square bits of... Oh, yeah, I was absolutely crucified. I was English in Wales, and the old singer and his mates were down there going, fuck off, you English cunt. It was horrific. We suffered so much abuse in the early days, well, nearly all the way through my time there. Some of the homophobic slurs, people would be locked away these days if they said that. They would be locked in jail, mate. We got so much shit you would not believe, but we persevered through it. And the worse it got, the more glam I got. We did a festival. Go on.
No, I want to hear about this festival.
Well, this is fast forward quite a lot. So ask me what you were going to do. I'm fast forwarding, getting way ahead of myself.
You guys get the last laugh in a way, like, because you have this over the top image, which like people just find offensive back then. But then all of a sudden, all the girls start loving it.
That's what we always said. You know, if you get them, all the blokes are down there as well. And it's all good. All paying punters. And there's a good crowd. But yeah, the abuse was horrific, mate. It really was. And some of it got physical as well, you know. You'd walk somewhere and, you know, I used to walk around with bright red lipstick on, man. I'd go to the shops like that. I wouldn't go down the shops unless I had my hair spiked up, lipstick on, and I'd go and buy some booze, you know. Yeah, the abuse was, you imagine, this was 1985. The abuse was unbelievable.
So what was this festival?
Well, the story was, we did the demo, and through my contacts with Tokyo Blade, obviously the drummer played on Shoot to Kill, Living Without You, She's Too Hot demo. Through my contacts, we got the manager from Tokyo Blade, Ian Rossiter, to manage us.
Right.
So he was a wheeler dealer, mate. I don't know whose idea it was, but we thought, we want to do a single. We want to bring it out as a single. We never made no fucking money out of that. He sold it out the back of his car. Whoever got the money for that, I don't know. I do know the studio bill was never paid, though. I do know that. The studio bill for the album when we first did it, he bailed on it and there was an outstanding bill. But we self-financed that first thing ourselves. It was a DIY project. All the photos were done by friends of ours and people we knew, photographers and stuff. We did a photo shoot for the cover. I do remember that because Fincham had actually joined the band when we did the 12-inch single cover because obviously he's on it, you know. We paid for a proper photo shoot for that. But yeah, it was a DIY job, mate. All the way through it up to when we got signed. But I digress. The thing is, I got Ian Rossiter involved to manage us. And with that came supports with Tokyo Blade, who reformed, if you like, with different people. Wasn't the band I auditioned with. It was the band that the guitar player, Andy Bolton, was in charge of. And he had a load of different people in the band. So we got this support tour with them. I can't even tell you how much fun it was. But we ended up going to Eindhoven. Across the channel, and I think it was 2 or 3 gigs on the way across the channel, because my dad came out there with us. He was my biggest fan. He was my best friend, all the rest of it. And he came out there with us. Imagine, this is a big ferry, a huge ferry. And over the tannoy, this voice said, would Mr. Ian Rossiter please come to the captain's desk? And what he'd done is he said there was only 6 of us or 8 of us traveling and there was 12 of us.
Oh, shit.
And they busted him for that, you know, but it was hilarious. And the first gig, we did 3 gigs with them in Holland. And the first night, you know, because we took hours to get ready, as you can imagine. We took hours to get ready. We were getting ready in the changing room. And he was like, come on, boys, you're on now. And we were like, fuck off, we ain't ready yet. So it was all comedy. And on the way there, this was the best one, he ran out of petrol in the transit van.
Legend.
You know, so we were like really late getting there. It was this dark, dingy pub. You would know as well as I do, Holland is heavy metal, absolutely heavy metal. And we were glam as fuck, mate. Anyway, we got to the Dynamo Club, which, you know, people like Slayer and all those bands have played there. And we were getting changed. Oh, Mick upset somebody in there. I think he said something to someone and thought they were Dutch and they were English and they hated him. And I remember getting ready in there and it was like, you better tone down tonight, lads, because it's a metal crowd out there. So what I did, I wore a pink outfit, pink boa with bright pink lipstick. And I said, fuck it. Let's just do it. And we went out there, mate. And I've never seen so... Fortunately, it was just plastic cups. It looked like confetti. And they were throwing shit at us and flipping us off and spitting at me. And so what did I do? I dived in the audience. My dad was there and he said, I didn't think you were going to come out of there. And in the end, mate, we won him over.
Exactly. I calls that. These guys have got some balls to do this. Incredible.
We did have big balls, all of us. We had big balls, mate, to do that. Because, you know, we got so much abuse wherever we went. And people wanted to fight with us all the time.
Almost like a challenge for you, though. Like, we're going to win them over in the end.
Exactly. I wore a pink outfit on purpose.
How can I wind them up even more?
Yeah, with a massive pink boa. And I went out there looking like Liberace, you know? It was just like, I think they just stopped in their tracks, all these kids, you know? And it took them a while. It took them a while to refocus, and then it was like bush, and the fucking abuse and everything else started. But yeah, by the end of the gig, I jumped in the audience, and I can remember it. I was just headbanging with them, and we won them over. We did.
You've mentioned Motley Crue earlier, but what other American bands were on your radar at this point? I guess you got Rat, but had you heard the buzz about Poison? Because their Cat Dragged It album came out around 86, I believe. So was they on your radar?
If we go back a little bit, when we were in LA in 1985, Poison were looking for a guitar player. We were told it was out of Slash and CC DeVille. I don't know how true that was.
That's the legendary story.
Yeah, so Poison were a big band and a big draw, but they weren't playing at the time because they were looking for a guitar player. So when we came back, everybody says, you were just copying Poison. You didn't. None of us really liked Poison. Mick would attest to that as well. We were into metal. You know, we wanted to be glam, as over the top as we possibly could, but we wanted to be heavy at the same time. I remember when the Look What the Cat Dragged In album came out, because obviously my friend Kelv Hellraiser, he was a massive Poison fan.
Was you friends with Kelv at that point?
I didn't really become massive friends with Kelv until I came back from America, and then it trickled through. I'd met him before, as he told me. He never approached me because he said, you look like you'd kill me. And I said, no, you should have come and talked to me. Anyway, it just trickled through, you know, and obviously he was massive friends with Poison and all those bands. Ace was friends with Kelv before I was, so I got involved with Kelv later down the line. But yeah, we were all aware of Poison, absolutely.
Like you say, you weren't Poison fans though, but you mentioned like the first Motley Crue record and the first Poison record. They're both very punk rock. And quite some metal riffs at the end of the day, as much as it's packaged.
I always got cheesed off. I know Mick felt the same way, that we were labelled the same as Poison. We weren't, you know, we weren't influenced by them. Me and Fincham were around in Treason when Rat and Motley Crue first boomed up, you know what I mean? So it was a different, I don't know what the word is for it, but I wasn't influenced. There you go, that's the easiest way to say it.
I just think it's almost like a coincidence that all these bands kind of gravitated at the same time, perhaps not even hearing about each other, but just happened to come out around that same time.
Yeah, we were aware of what was going on everywhere because Fincham was American, you know, or born here, but basically American. And we were aware of everything that was going on. One of the biggest bands for us at that time was David Lee Roth's band.
Right.
You know, because we actually did a bit in the show where Mick and the boy, Jay and Pepsi, for anybody who's confused, they did this bit where they swatted each other with towels, and that was stolen from David Lee Roth's band.
Where had you seen that? Just on videos, or had you seen them on tour?
Yeah, bootleg videos, VHS bootleg videos. That's the kind of thing we just used to get cheesed off. Just because of the way we looked, we were exactly like Poison, where we weren't. We were ourselves, you know?
I don't want to miss out too much history, but there's a lot of other bits I want to talk about. But Young and Crazy would be released in 1987, but you would leave the band early the following year. Was that tough for you after so long going through all these bands and you get a deal, then suddenly you're out on your own? Where was your head at?
It broke my heart. It messed me up. And I turned to drink even more than I had done. I was just a mess, you know, because I'd done so much groundwork and hard work building the band with Mick and Pepsi and getting Fincham and building it. People don't realise I was only in the band for 3 years. It wasn't long, but the explosion was massive. You know what I mean? It was massive. We were selling out two nights at the Marquee without a record deal. No band in London, Queer Boys, as they were called then, Thunder, I don't know what they were called back then. I think they might have been called something.
Terraplane, weren't they?
None of them could sell out two nights at the Marquee. We had queues. Mate, we had queues going round Wardour Street up to the Oxford Street and beyond. People couldn't get in. It was massive. You know, people don't understand.
What was the percentage of male to female?
I think it was 70-30.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, as you know, it was a lot. But if you aren't aware of what was going in England, you weren't aware of how big the buzz was on us. It was massive, you know, and it was like, this is what I'd work for. And getting back to your point there. Yeah, the official line was, I was asked to leave. And it was all really cloak and dagger stuff. I'd already heard that they had a new singer from my friend who worked in Carnaby Street. He came up to me one day and he said, I hear you're out of the band and they've got a new singer. And I said, that's news to me. He said, I've just heard him in the tea shop talking about it. So I kind of knew. So when I went in I was called into the Music for Nations office. I forget who it was. Martin Hooker, who's died, long since dead now. He never liked me because I said what I thought and they didn't like that. And the rest of the band do as they told, you know, and I was never like that. And at the time, I wanted to leave. I wasn't happy. The last tour I did, I just wasn't happy and no one was really speaking to me. I mean, it was my own fault. I built a monster and the monster destroyed me. I was Frankenstein, really. You know, if I turned up a bit late, I missed the train somewhere and I turned up late to a gig and they all thought I'd be paralytic and I'd been drinking and I hadn't. I just missed the train. It was innocent.
Yeah, like any innocent things just amplified because of perhaps some other things.
It was a conglomeration, mate. And the crux of the matter was I was in Kerrang every week, view from the bar, whatever you called it, about getting into scrapes and fights. And I remember the conversation. He put Kerrang on the table in Music for Nation. He said, any more of this and you're out. And I was like, oh, okay. I said, I thought that was selling records for us. It was rock and roll, you know. If it's Axl doing it, they would have been carrying him around on a throne. So, yeah, I kind of knew about it, you know. So, but I went along with it and I thought, well, you two really don't like me. I really don't like you. It's probably for the best, you know. So it wasn't a shocker because I was kind of pre-warned about it. It was weird. It was surreal, mate. It was really strange. When I joined that band, especially when Fincham joined, it was a gang. To me, it was a gang.
The best kind of band.
It was the four of us against the fucking world. Yeah, the four of us against the world, you know. You know, we went out and conquered. We played in Carlisle, drove all the way up in a Luton van, taking it in turns to sit in the back to Carlisle to play for three people. But we played like it was Wembley Arena. We didn't care who was there.
That's the only way to do it back then.
We conquered, mate. We absolutely went out of our way to be larger than life. We really did, you know.
Did you ever consider relocating to America? Because I know you went out there at one point. I think you were going to audition for the band Cherry Street, but Stevie Rochelle of Tough kind of gave you some hard truths, apparently.
Yeah, what happened was I joined Cherry Street. I'd asked a load of people about it, and they said, oh, it's a big, you know, are they going to do this? Are they going to do that? They promised me they had a record deal, which they subsequently got after I left. But I had really, really bad time at the airport. They took all the stuff out of my bag again. And
was you wearing a suit again?
I wasn't. I was rock and roll this time. And I thought, it started off really bad. It's not going to end well. And I was right. I wasn't happy. Can't remember details. I can remember little bit snippets, you know. But I wasn't happy. And consequently, because of Kelv and his association with Stevie and Tuff, I don't know if he called me or I called him. And I remember the conversation going along the lines of, what are you doing? And I said to him, what do you mean? He said, those guys are clowns. He said, we all wondered what you were doing. And I kind of thought, shit, well, what am I going to do? And I ended up moving into the old Tuff Muff Mansion.
What year was this?
God, when was it? 91, 92? I may be wrong. I can't remember. It was just before the album was going to be released. Right. They'd already done it. I went to the video shoot that night when they did I Hate Kissing You Goodbye.
How was that?
It was a massive production, mate. I was like, Jesus Christ, these guys are going places. But it was on the tail end of everything. There was a buzz about them, you know what I mean? But I kept thinking in the back of my mind, it's pretty much fading out now, you know?
Could you see that, though, out on the... I mean, was it still cool for you to go out like, on the Sunset Strip and all that kind of thing?
Oh, mate, it was manic out there then. It was manic. It was when people... There was thousands walking up and down, you know? It was absolutely mental. When me and Fincham went there, we went to Hollywood, but it wasn't like it was then. I mean, 85 was different. I mean, we went and saw King Cobra supporting Queensryche at the Palladium, I think it was. I don't ever remember it being as buzzy as it was then, you know, because I went out there with Kelvin. Actually, I went out there the month Young and Crazy was released, so around about October. And it's weird. We're playing in October, and that's the year that the album came out in 87, you know. It's a coincidence there as well. So Young and Crazy was released in October of 87. I went to LA with Kelv. I should have stayed here and done press. I remember it. But I thought I could spread the word out there. But obviously, it wasn't released out there yet. It hadn't come out on Combat. Yeah, it was manic. It was like another world.
But didn't you see Warrant at the Whiskey before their first record even came out?
Yes. Went out with Kelv because everybody wanted to know him because he was a journalist. Every band in the world wanted to know him. We had these passes to go and see. I think it was a showcase evening, if I'm right. There was a band me and Kelv really used to like. Something Child, Tomorrow's Child. That's it. They were great. Then it was Demoles, who'd just been signed to Atlantic. Then it was LA Guns, who'd just been signed to Phonogram. And then it was Warrant, who'd just been signed to CBS.
Unreal.
I remember thinking, wow, LA Guns, man, they are smoking. They were great. And I thought, you know, I thought Warrant, and I don't know, they're all right. They weren't great.
They had all the moves back then.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, as you know, Janie Lane, best songwriter of his era by a thousand years. But when the albums came out, it was back to front for me, because LA Guns I didn't really like, and the Warrant album I really did like. So it was like a reversal in fortunes from when I saw them, if you like.
Did you go to the Cat Ass when you was out there?
I did, yes. I'm going to be brutally honest, mate. I was so wasted, I don't remember a lot of it. Kelv used to tell me things, and I'd say, how can you remember that? He'd say, because I was sober. But yes, we did go there. We went, I'll tell you where we went as well. We went to a couple of after shows. We went to see London when they filmed that fucking, what is it, Civilization World? What's it called?
Oh, Decline of the Western Civilization.
We were there when they were filming London with the massive explosions going off. We were there watching them. That was in Gazaris. We went to the after show and I misbehaved and we got thrown out.
They should have recorded that for the documentary.
What, me in the rooms? Yeah, I remember the guitar player from the Kicks was there and there's a few other people. Yeah, I got carried away. I was drunk and, as usual, got carried away and misbehaved and it was time to leave. But anyway, yeah, we also went and saw Sweet Savage. They were great. I think we saw them at the, not the Whiskey, what's the one in the middle?
Oh, the Roxy.
Roxy, yeah, I love that place. We also saw Tuff in there as well, obviously, in their heyday. But Sweet Savage were great, and I never understood why they didn't get signed. But I do understand it more now. And I became friends with Joey before he passed away, you know. And I always used to think Joey C. Jones, same kind of luck as me, same kind of vibe.
Kelf put me in touch with Joey C. Jones years ago, yeah.
Lovely guy, yeah, lovely guy. We met up with them and Kelf was doing his thing and stuff, so I was just hanging out, you know, with all these people. Have you seen the photograph that I've posted before? Me, Les, Kelf, obviously, Bobby Dow.
I have seen that one, yes. That's a great one.
Well, you know who took that photograph, don't you?
Who took it?
Janie Lane.
It gets better.
That was upstairs in the Rainbow. They've got that room upstairs. Didn't the vampires or something all go up there?
That's right, yeah, the Hollywood vampires.
Yeah, we went upstairs up there. I don't know how it transpired even, but we went up there, obviously with Bobby Dow. Through Kelv, I met Poison, and Bobby Dow was the nicest one. The rest of them were arseholes, in my opinion. But Bobby Dow was really, really nice. And, you know, we went upstairs and we were hanging out and drinking. I'm extremely drunk in that photograph, as per. But yeah, Janie Lane took that photograph. He was up there.
Nuts, man.
Got weird little quirks all the time, you know?
Yeah, I love it. I love hearing stuff like that. But you say everybody wanted to know Kelv. Because, I mean, I remember Kelv from just like little columns in like Metal Forces and stuff. But just a few words would like influence. You'd like, oh, Kelv says this is a good band. I got to check him out. But
absolutely.
What's the story about Sebastian Bach wanting to know Kelv?
Well, Kelv knew him anyway because they did a signing in Shades, you know. But fast forward a little bit. But I ended up in the Moritz, quite drunk. The club in London called the Moritz. And I went downstairs and Skid Row were all in there. I think they must have just played and that was the after. I don't know what it was, but I remember walking around and I vividly remember this guy coming past me all the time and he'd just whisper, has been. And I used to think, the fuck is this guy on? Why does he keep doing it? And he kept winding me up. In the end, I went over to Rachel Boland, the bass player. I said, is this one of your entourage? Because if it is, I'm going to fucking crack him soon. And he just kind of stuck his nose up. Anyway, the guy, don't know who he was to this day. I couldn't tell you. I don't know what his game was. And I didn't end up getting in a fight, thankfully. But I ended up at a table with Sebastian Bach. Everybody was drinking. And of course, the table was surrounded by people wanting to know him. And all of a sudden, he recognized me. And he was like, Stevie James, Tiger Tails. I was like, yep, all right. And then all the people started talking to me. And I was thinking, oh, this is all right. You know, I'll have a bit of a chat here. He was a strange man sometimes. I think that was in his coke-addled days, you know. But I kind of became friendly with him, yeah. And at the end of the night, because I told him about Kelv and his records, and he had to go and see his record collection. This is 2, 3, 4 in the morning. I don't know what it was. So we all bundled into a cab and we went over to Finchley where Kelv lived. We all got out of the cab. Sebastian, 6'9" or whatever the fuck he is. Well, we know what it's like in England. Got the little windows that you can put your arm through, but you can't put it far down because you're not tall enough. He was tall enough. Put his arm in and tried to open the window inside. I was outside with one of those cones from the workman with a loud hailer. I was going, Kel, let me in your house. It was all getting a bit noisy. Anyway, I remember Kel's missus at the time, Janet, coming to the window. Sebastian Bach said, it's me, Sebastian Bach. I want to come in and see Kel's record collection. And she looked at him. She said, I don't give a fuck who you are. If you don't fuck off now, I'm going to call the police. So that ended that night.
Oh, incredible.
It was funny. It was really funny.
Mate, I could talk about this stuff for hours.
Oh, me too.
The last 10 years or so have been pretty quiet for Stevie James when it comes to live and recording. But that's all about to change with this anniversary show in October.
Can't wait.
How do you feel about getting back out there?
Mate, I can't tell you how excited I am. You know what Robin's like. Robin's a big inspiration. Robin's been behind this from day dot. If it weren't for him, I wouldn't be doing it. And you talk to him and you get a vibe and then you get your own ideas and then it goes on, then it goes on. Then he got you. And then Robin, out of the blue, said, I've got someone. And he sent me a picture of Kai, and I went, Jesus Christ. This is 1987 spec. It's all stemmed from there, mate. And I'm so excited about it. I've got to tell you.
The response just online has been, like, incredible. Just such a warm response from everybody.
It's been great. It's really been great, you know. And it's nice to know I'm preaching to the converted with you because you're involved in it. But it's just all about fun, you know, all about fun and enjoying yourselves and playing an album that is 35 years old. But it's got a lot more respect now than it did when it came out.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
just a lot of positivity and excitement just to enjoy these songs, enjoy this album that meant so much to everybody.
Enjoy this show, Rob. It's going to be a show, a special show, you know. It's going to be awesome because we never did that album back to back or in its entirety, if you like. The last time I sang some of these songs, like She's Too Hot and Shameless, was in 1988 on the last tour I did.
Wow.
You know? So, you know, I'm oiling my voice up. I'm not 24 anymore. I'm 60 years old now. I think it's going to be a great night, mate. I really do. I'm so excited about it, you know, working with you, working with Robin, working with Kai. I just think it's going to be great. And because we're all into the same thing, having fun, it should resonate with everybody else.
Yeah, definitely, man. Definitely.
It's going to be a great show, you know. Event. I call it an event. I don't call it a show. It's an event for me. It's a once, not once in a lifetime, but a one-off event that, you know, it's going to be so good. I'm really, really, really excited about it.
Awesome, man. Awesome. Well, I have loved chatting with you, and I'm glad we got to do this.
Absolutely, mate. I wish we could have talked for another hour. I've got so many stories, but you can only fill in so much.
We'll have to do a part two.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do a part two, because I've skipped so much stuff, because when I get going, I just get going, you know. But in my head, I'm still 24 and I'm reminiscing.
Yeah, that's the best way to be, mate. Best way to be.
Absolutely, mate. You know, it was, you know, the 80s, I was just into the whole trip of it all, you know, and it was great fun. It was great fun. And that's what's missing now.
It's been a lot of fun hearing these stories. I can't wait to hear some more in the future.
Oh, you'll get to hear plenty, mate. Don't you worry. All right, mate. Listen, it's been lovely talking to you, Rob.
Likewise, mate. You take care. Enjoy the rest of your day and I'll speak to you soon.
And you, mate. And you. Take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Big thanks to Stevie James for being so much fun and entertaining us with his stories and memories right here on the Straight to Video podcast. The 35th anniversary Young and Crazy gig at London's 229 Club is on the 15th of October, and tickets are on sale now through ctickets.com and wegottickets.com. So if you want to be there, please grab one whilst you can, as the response has been super cool already. And I want to thank you all for continuing to listen to this podcast. I'm really enjoying these conversations and feel the guests are serving up some gold for you. So thanks for always coming back, and any shares and comments you can send the show's way are massively appreciated. So that is all for today's episode. Hope you've enjoyed it, and I look forward to another one this time next week.